It's Johnny's.
Good morning. Welcome to the March 22nd meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We are going to start with a couple of work sessions this morning. We're going to begin with a work session on House Bill 2160. And I'm going to open a work session and invite Mr. Crawford to describe the bill for us, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2160 allows a brewery public house licensee to hold an off-premise sales license. The committee is being asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments. They allow brewery public house licensees to conduct activities accepting manufacturing at two locations.
And I'm going to actually invite forward Mr. Paul Romaine to describe the Dash 1 amendments, and I know that you worked on developing some consensus around how that might look. So if you could please just describe those for us, then we can consider a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. As with most bills dealing with alcohol licensing, we try and come to a consensus among everybody affected, including the regulatory agency and the people involved. We brought together, after your initial hearing on 2160, the representatives from the Oregon Brewers Guild, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, our folks, and we sat down and we figured out what the problem was and devised a very simple solution. The solution is, and the problem was that selling for off-premise consumption at restaurants that were connected with the brew pub, but were more than one, brew pub licensee is allowed one location under their license. What this does, the amendment simply gives them two locations under the same license. They don't have to get another license, the expense of another license, the old license. But it still keeps the character of a brew pub, which is the idea of a brew pub is you're brewing. And, you know, you can't be brewing in one place and then have 25 locations where you're not brewing. Then you're not really a brew pub. So this keeps the character, solves the problem. Everybody seems to be happy with it. So we would encourage your adoption of the amendment, and it would go a long way to solving the problem. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yes, please, Rep. Post.
Thank you. Just for clarification, so that can visualize in my mind, Madam Chair, just Paul wanted to ask you, could you name one location or one brew pub that you maybe just comes to mind that describes this well? Not the 25 and one, but one that has a second location.
Well, the obvious, Madam Chair, Representative Post, the obvious one is McMenamin's, who has, they have a number of brew pub licenses. They're not a brewery. They brew in a lot of locations, and attached to each one of those locations is probably another one, at least one. Now there could be two locations where they can basically do the same thing without brewing.
Okay.
So it just makes it easier for everybody. You're getting it under one license. You don't have to get a separate license.
Yeah.
Makes it simple.
Okay.
Thank you. So this is a continuation of work we considered. Thanks. You can go ahead and sit down.
Thank you.
A continuation of work that we started with the Committee on Small Business Growth, the intention of which is to cut through red tape, streamline regulations where we can to help our beverage sector, adult beverage sector, which is really a robust and creative and dynamic sector in Oregon, continue to grow and increase market share. And I want to thank Mr. Romaine for, and Danelle Romaine also, for work that you did to help us pathfind some opportunities together with OLCC to cut red tape so that we could support these businesses at no cost to the state. So with that, I would welcome a motion from Vice Chair Brocksmith.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 8, 2017, for House Bill 2160.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 8, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And now I'd welcome a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2160 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2160 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. Rep. Post, would you like to carry that?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Thank you. All right, we're closing the work session on House Bill 2160. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2242. Mr. Crawford, could you please refresh our recollection on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2242 defines traded sector activities as activities that produce goods and services for markets in which national or international competition exists. It includes convention facilities, destination facilities, office buildings, and corporate headquarters as a business development project. Excludes shopping centers, food service facilities, or activities engaged in retail or service businesses not in the traded sector. Provides exemptions for business development projects in non-traded sector service areas and retail businesses operated by emerging small business enterprises in rural or distressed areas.
Wonderful. I'm going to actually invite forward a gentleman from Business Oregon because we may have a question or two from the panel on this bill. But again, it's scheduled for a work session and there are no amendments to it. But welcome. Representative Clem, did you want to ask for some additional information, and I figured we could just have the whole committee be able to benefit from good context.
Benefit may be a stretch, but I'm going to try. Okay, so what I am trying to follow here is the change, really, from current law to this, what appears to be focus on traded sector activities, but I may be reading wrong. So it looks to me like there's a definition of business development project, which sort of talks about real property, it seems like, mostly, although it does say including working capital. And so then it deletes a whole bunch of kinds of activities that these funds could be used for. Like previously, it's defined a business development project as this type of property that was to promote the development of one or more of the following activities, and there's a whole list of things that it was meant to do, and those are all being deleted, and instead it's tying it just to traded sector activities. Am I reading this wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the finance manager at Business Oregon. Representative Clem, you're not reading it incorrectly. The intent of the legislation was to modernize the eligible activities that are considered to be in the support of traded sector. When this legislation was introduced in the mid-80s, there's certain traded sector activities that we commonly see now in our state that weren't necessarily contemplated, software and professional services being two of the core ones. And what this does allow us to do is to help provide financing that would support their manufacturing activities, which isn't going to occur in a traditional manufacturing plant. They need office space and headquarters, which are two types of properties that are explicitly disallowed under the current law.
Okay. Follow up.
Please do.
So what I'm envisioning in my head here, given I sort of work in the ag world and chair ag, I see agriculture development being deleted and traded sector being put in. So if there were a business development project that was to build a public market in Portland, and all of the people are small farmers who grow regionally and sell locally only, no exports. They grow, they go to farmers market, they sell in the Portland farmers market. It looks to me like this bill would make them ineligible when they prior to this bill were eligible, because you're deleting agricultural development as one of the things that the business development projects can be used for, and instead putting in traded sector activities.
Representative Clint, where that would still be captured is under the definition of traded sector. If you go to the statute that defines traded sector, it says basically businesses and companies that create products and sell products in markets where national and international competition exists. So what we've gotten away from is listing every type of possible manufacturing industry and falling back on the traded sector definition as what is considered to be an eligible activity.
So one last one.
Please, yes.
So whether that company is, like my computer business here in Salem is not traded sector, but there are multinational and national entities in the market, like the Geek Squad is a is a national company, I'm technically considered traded sector because I have competition from people who do business outside of just Oregon.
Depending on the types of services provided, you could be.
Okay.
So it sounds like the answer to the specific question that Rep. Clem asked was that the kind of project for agricultural producers that he described, given that agricultural products are face steep competition in an international context, would continue to be encompassed by the opportunity for support, and that would be because of the definition of traded sector, not because of a specific call out in the bill. And so do you feel comfortable with what you heard?
Yeah, it sounds like for legislative intent purposes, nothing's being taken out or narrowed. This is just broadening.
Great.
It's just worded a little weird in the summary because it used the word restricts, and I think LC must have saw what I saw a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great. So with that, would you have a comment or question, Russ?
Just a comment. I appreciate the questions because I had the same concerns. So thanks for the definition.
Thank you. And with that, I would welcome a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rocksmith moves House Bill 2242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Representative Lewis, would you be interested in carrying this bill?
Sure.
Wonderful. Great. All right. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2242. We have a member who is has some limited availability, and so I think, hang on just a second. Okay. So we're going to actually open a public hearing on House Bill 2950. And then for the folks who are here for the transient lodging tax and local lodging fee outcomes work, I want to note that we're going to be opening those afterwards. We should certainly have that done. We'll have those open probably within the next 15 minutes, and I expect to open those public hearings separately since the bills are in the interest of trying to keep things clear between the two bills that are open after we have the informational hearing. All right, go ahead, Mr. Crawford, as to 2950, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2950 appropriates $1.54 million to the City of St. Helens for central waterfront redevelopment and Portland Harbor cleanup support. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. It has a sub-referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Welcome, Representative Witt. This is an exciting bill, and we would welcome any additional introduction or context that you'd like to provide before we go into a couple of witnesses.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31, appearing before you this morning in favor of House Bill 2950, a bill that would make or provide for a $1.5 million general fund appropriation to DAS for disbursement to the City of St. Helens for really three types of purposes. One, a feasibility study for the project, which I will explain here in a minute. The 40,000-foot level explanation, by the way. Initiation of the permitting process for the project and project validation, all of which are intended for the purposes of creation of a landfill in St. Helens that would receive, among other soils, various dredge sediments from in-water and potentially brownfield cleanup projects. More specifically, the money will be used to initiate redevelopment of the city's vastly oversized wastewater treatment lagoon. The lagoon was considerably larger, or built large, because of the former Boise Cascade mill site, which now has largely disappeared, and there's overcapacity there. The lagoon would become a low-cost disposal site for the projected 15 to 20-year Superfund cleanup for the Portland Harbor, as well as any number of ports, docks, marinas, sloughs, and other waterfront properties, et cetera. And I mentioned earlier, potentially even brownfields. Filling in the lagoon would benefit St. Helens simply by filling in the lagoon, first of all, and in so doing, adding roughly 40 acres of waterfront property, connecting the St. Helens community with the former Boise Cascade mill site, which can be developed, and also the riverfront district. And the landfill would also become a source of ongoing revenue that the city would be able to use for its redevelopment of a roughly 200-acre waterfront property site. Our state and other entities involved with the Portland Harbor cleanup, as well as any other cleanup projects, would also benefit by having a close-in and low-cost disposal site available to them. So the project is hopefully a win-win project, both for the city as well as the state and other entities. And on that basis, I would ask for your positive consideration of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do we have any questions for Representative Witt? I would like to note that I think this seems like a creative and important idea. And really, as we have, I formerly worked with Oregon Ironworks, which was acquired by Vigor. And I heard time and again from manufacturers that one of the most important things that we can do to support economic vitality and economic development in the Portland metropolitan area is put to rest the uncertainty around the Portland Harbor cleanup, and to the extent that this project is beneficial both for the city of St. Helens and also would facilitate an affordably priced and expeditious cleanup of the Portland Harbor, I think that that's a really wonderful win-win tie-in. So thank you for your creativity in thinking about that.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And yes, it not only provides an opportunity for assisting in the cleanup of the Superfund site, but also presumably into the future will make available a site right in the waterfront of the city of St. Helens, which will become such a valuable piece of real estate. And a lagoon there doesn't do much in terms of attracting development or enabling connectivity with other portions of that waterfront. So yes, this is I truly believe this will be a win-win project.
Great. Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. It's been a while since I've been through St. Helens, probably 20 years. So I think a lot's gone on since then as Portland has grown, population has moved out. And I just wondered what the estimated population of St. Helens is compared to 20 years ago. Or is my thinking correct that it's grown and this space is needed for that growth?
Yes. Representative, Madam Chair, committee members, most of the growth in Columbia County is located in the southern part of the county. City administrator is here today, along with at least one counselor I know. They will be able to give you better figures than I. The growth rate has been much greater south of St. Helens in the Scappoose area. There has been actually some, I think, out-migration in St. Helens with some of the former mill workers. But as population continues to increase in the southern portion of the county, St. Helens is also experiencing growth. And the traffic jams aren't quite as bad in St. Helens yet as they are in Scappoose, but we're facing a good number of challenges in Southern County due to population increases, and quite frankly, an infrastructure that is has not kept pace with the population growth.
Great. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Representative Witt. We have a couple of additional witnesses. You're welcome to go back to the other committee things
that
you've got.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your bringing this forward. I'd like to now call forward John Walsh of the City of St. Helens and Jim McKenna of Governor Brown's, one of Governor Brown's policy advisors. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
So my name is John Walsh. I am the city administrator for the City of St. Helens, and thank you for having us here today to talk about this House Bill 2950 and the city's request for funding to further this, our city's waterfront redevelopment project. And the waterfront redevelopment project has, what we're talking about today is the central waterfront, or the repurposing of the lagoon more specifically. But I wanted to show some slides today that offered some context of how that fit into the community and the region. And I think Representative Witt did an excellent job of connecting the two, the mutually beneficial relationship between the greater region and the community. But well, hopefully we'll have some pictures to make that more relevant. With me is
Jim McKenna with the Governor's Natural Resource Office, policy analyst specific to Portland Harbor Cleanup Project.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Okay, so this first slide is my challenge is to put a whole lot of information into very brief context, but for those of you who may not know where or be familiar with the City of St. Helens, it's about 30 miles by road, a little bit shorter than that distance by water, from the Portland Harbor Project to the City of St. Helens. Okay, this slide offers you can see at the top of the slide is the former Vanille Mill property. The circled area is the lagoon, and to the south of it is the white paper, which currently houses Cascades Tissue. But the lagoon is grossly oversized because of the no longer making paper pulp there. We've been very active and are proactive with our planning efforts. Since the 2000s, we've recognized that the mills were going to go away, and we've moved forward with redevelopment planning efforts, and we've done a pretty impressive body of work, I believe, with looking at the future of St. Helens, what those properties might be, you know, connecting people to the water. This industrial nature of the sites really cut people off from the water, and the city's involvement and now acquisition of all of the properties you see there. I've offered this opportunity to have public access and get people back connected to the water in the community, because it was the economic heart of the city from its origination, and now we're trying to recreate that. So this offers some pretty good context. This is at the foreground you'll see the Columbia County Courthouse, which is the iconic Columbia County. The veneer mill site, and you'll see the lagoon off in the background there. So that's 23 acres, 50 acres, and 200 acres behind it. And you'll see it kind of interrupts the continuity between the projects there. And it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to see roads that connect and loop through and provide access to the water. Wrong way again. So this is some brief slides from called the Sustainable Design Assessment Team, which is a program out of the American Institute of Architects. The city was selected a few years ago, the only project in the country that they took on that year as a design charrette, and they came out with a team of experts and offered some independent third-party advice and really got things rolling in this public engagement piece. But more than the waterfront, we've had the benefit of this connectivity concept of the notion of connecting the waterfront to the highway system. So we've been the benefit of a corridor master plan that programs, does some refinement planning with the from Highway 30 down to the water. And then there's another one working on right now as a riverfront connector that gets people from the water back out to the highway. So a business loop kind of concept. Our public engagement efforts have been very impressive. We've won good governance awards for the level of involvement. We have a community of 13,000. I think that was a question earlier. Back in the 80s, I think it was 7,500, 8,000-ish. So it's had some fair level of growth. But throughout all this planning process, the core values have been public access, you know, preserving that natural culture heritage, and then sustainable economic development. We want people to enjoy the water, but it needs to be in productive use as well. So here's a rendering of one possible concept, a mixed-use kind of concept on the Vanier property. So more specifically about the lagoon, I think Representative Witt kind of hit this. It was designed for sewage. It was a shared facility between the city and Boise Cascade. It was designed for 40 million gallon a day treatment load. Today it's about 3 million gallons. So it's, as you can see, just by the numbers there, it's a pretty largely underutilized. So the city's done a fair amount of work on the lagoon. We've completed a technical and feasibility analysis. We tried to understand the market by doing a market analysis, and there is a significant amount of market for sediment, and explored the governance option of how that might operate. It would be a city-owned, and a number of questions that yet to be answered. So this slide shows the gray would be the lagoon volume. The varying colors of yellow and orange. There are other markets. This is a product that came out of the market analysis. And since the record of decision has come out, those numbers have increased to only show that there's plenty of capacity, whether through its Portland Harbor, brownfields, channel maintenance, and other activities. So we're not looking at creating a landfill in the with a specific purpose landfill, even though the permitting is very similar. We're looking at sediment, sludge that's in the existing lagoon already. Part of this effort is to have the remediation also solve the city's interest in the sludge, the existing material that's in there, so that we'd have. So we're not looking at construction waste or anything of that nature. There's really no other competitive facilities in the region. This facility offers, it's close for one. It has barge, rail, and truck access for two, and it's the only facility that can directly go from barge to the facility without a transload. So the economic benefits of that, the rehandling cost and expense of that, the greenhouse emission piece of it, there's a lot of real positive factors. We pretty well talked about that. So as far as employment, this is likely a 20-year project, depending on the fill rate and how quickly things move along. So there's some employment. It's a very expensive endeavor, the Portland Harbor specifically is. So there would be a lot of jobs for a long time. Importantly, a facility in Oregon keeps the money in Oregon, which is, we think, is a good benefit. So here's just a perspective slide that shows the past, a picture from the 20s, today, present at the lagoon, and then some potential repurposing concepts, throwing in amphitheaters and ball fields and housing, and one last one that shows a connectivity to the industrial areas close by for the employment centers and things. Nice. On one side, and the other side, it connects to the Vanier.
Great. Thank you so much. We appreciate that.
Okay.
Yes, again, Madam Chair, committee members, Jim McKenna with the Governor's Natural Resource Office. Obviously, this bill, the monies that the city is seeking are not in the governor's budget, so we're neutral on the bill, but I did want to express why this particular project has keen interest in the governor's office and how we feel if this project were to come to fruition, it could address two of the governor's key priorities. Families with children and economic growth, job growth, of family wage jobs. From the family and children, now you see from this slide, the last one that the city put up, there's a great opportunity to provide facilities, recreational facilities, access to the river, wetlands, and shallow water habitat, all that would be great amenities for families and with children in this neighborhood. In terms of Portland Harbor, and it could help both expedite but also provide a low-cost option for disposal of materials from Portland Harbor. It cleans up Portland Harbor sooner rather than later and provides access for the parks down there for families with children to get down and enjoy that river as well. And, John, I was going to ask just real quick if you could click back to your opening map. Again, as we look at this from the governor's perspective of job growth and benefits to the community. You look at this map, and as John pointed out, St. Helens is right downriver from the Portland Harbor Superfund site. EPA's record of decision that came out in January of 2017 calls for the dredging of a lot of material from Portland Harbor, upwards of a couple million cubic yards. That record of decision from EPA says it needs to go to a subtitle D, a solid waste landfill. There's a small portion of that may be classified as hazardous waste that'll go to a hazardous waste landfill, but that's just a small fraction of the sediments that'll be dredged. The vast majority of the sediments that'll be dredged will have low enough concentrations that they can go into a solid waste subtitle D landfill, such as the one they're proposing. The existing landfills are off of this map. They're either in eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, that would be accessed by barge. The Hillsboro landfill, which is off the map a bit to the, or almost off the map to the left there, all the material had to be trucked. And when you're talking millions of cubic yards of material and putting that in dump trucks 10 cubic yards at a time, folks at the Oregon DEQ calculated that if you lined up those trucks bumper to bumper, they would go from Portland to Washington, D.C. It's a lot of truck traffic to have to take out through various communities. Here with the City of St. Helens proposal, we could barge it either down the Columbia River or down the Multnomah Channel right to the facility and offload directly into the facility. So there's some real benefits here. In terms of the Portland Harbor cleanup, I think it's important to recognize that the state itself has been identified as a potential responsible party through the Department of State Lands and Department of Transportation. So at the end of the day, the state itself may be held responsible for a portion of the share of the cost for the cleanup. So if we can identify an alternative that is protective of human health and the environment, meets EPA's cleanup goals, but is the lowest cost disposal option, that's in the interest of the state. And it would be in the interest of all the other PRPs as well, which include other government entities. So unfortunately, a portion of this cleanup at Portland Harbor will fall on the public. So finding the most cost-effective disposal option is in everyone's interest. So we see this as really providing a unique opportunity for enhancing the community, enhancing a small community, bringing family wage jobs to a small community, but also benefiting the cleanup as well in terms of timeliness and cost effectiveness.
Excellent. Thank you. Do we have any questions for these witnesses? Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming. Real quick, is this filling the entire lagoon? Is that the project, or is it just most of it?
We've evaluated essentially three primary scenarios, and the first two of them could potentially leave the wastewater treatment plant in place. The third would fill and require relocation of the wastewater treatment plant.
Quick follow-up?
Yes, please.
So let's say you did fill in the entire lagoon. Is there enough capacity in other wastewater treatment that you have that the city could potentially double in size? Because I'm thinking of the OMIC project that we heard that's going in Scappoose, which is going to drive a lot of residents there, but I think it's going to flow out to St. Helens as well. So I expect your population base to grow as well. So I'm just wanting to know that we have, if we move forward with this, is there enough capacity for the city of St. Helens to double without having to come back and say we need more money for now a wastewater treatment plant because we didn't anticipate growth?
So the revenue from the project and the would fund a relocation of a facility that would be appropriately sized for however large it needed to be.
Okay.
And that's kind of a third prong of one of the aspects we looked at through our feasibility analysis is that, you know, if we can't just go without a wastewater treatment plant.
Right.
So it's a critical infrastructure so that, you know, the revenues from this project would have to fund the filling of the lagoon and then also the whatever relocation costs are necessary, which would be in the one scenario, a relocation.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent.
Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, to add on to John's response to that, you know, that again, the governor's office is very intrigued with this project, and mm-hmm. we've already had the regional solutions team headed by Mark Ellsworth in this region working with the city to help them evaluate a lot of those ancillary issues yeah. that may come about through this project, but also to bring to the table some resources from the state to help them with those type of questions.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So to recap, we have a bill here before us today that would essentially endorse the appropriation by the Ways and Means Committee of $1.54 million to support development of this project. So if we, and go ahead, you may go ahead and sit down. Thank you so much. I'm going to request a motion to pass House Bill 2950, but be aware that it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So just as a number of our additional bills that would support economic development opportunities, whether or not it's ultimately funded is going to be determined by the budgeting process and availability of funds. But I think this is a really exciting project that supports a lot of important community needs simultaneously. So thanks again, Representative Witt. I'd welcome the motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2950 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2950 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Thank you. And since we don't have a direct vote on it, we will have that go on to Ways and Means. Thanks. That's a great project. Appreciate it. Okay. Now, we're actually going to do a quick rule suspension. I'm going to request a motion for a rule suspension so that one of our committee members who had to step out and testify on some other bills has a chance to vote on a couple of the bills that we've already done. And then we'll move into the hearing and information session on travel and tourism. Representative
Brocksmith. Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Rep. Marsh to vote on House Bill 2160. This will not affect the outcome.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Marsh to vote on House Bill 2160. It will not affect the outcome. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the rules are suspended. Representative Marsh, how do you vote on House Bill 2160?
Aye.
All right. Let the record reflect that.
Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Rep. Marsh to vote on House Bill 2242. This will not affect the outcome.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Marsh to vote on House Bill 2242. This will not affect the outcome. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Representative Marsh, how do you vote?
Aye.
All right, then. So we are now closing that section of the meeting and opening an informational hearing on local lodging and fee outcomes. We're going to invite forward Todd Davidson, Chief Executive Officer of Travel Oregon, and then after that we will move into House Bill 2768, and following that, House Bill 2744, both are public hearings. Welcome, Mr. Davidson.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here before you today. Must be a joy for you to open your day dealing with Oregon craft beer. Not a bad way, my friends, to begin your day. It is my pleasure to be here before you today and to be able to speak to really provide you some context over two of the bills that you're going to be considering this morning as it relates to local lodging taxes. And the reason I'm able to provide you some of that context today, and there will be folks that will be, I'm sure, testifying later from both sides that will share their perspectives on that context. But my intention here today is to really speak to some of the history of local lodging tax, and so that you would have that as a context as you contemplate these bills as you go forward today. According to the most recent report on the economic impact of travel in Oregon, which was done in 2015 for the Oregon Tourism Commission by Dean Runyon and Associates out of Portland, there are over 100 local jurisdictions that are collecting a local lodging tax, roughly 91 cities and 16 counties that are collecting local transient lodging taxes. These local transient lodging taxes range from approximately 3% to 13.5%, with various percentages of revenues then being directed back into the local tourism industry, and the balance then being available to local governments to use in general funds or for other purposes. In 2003, the Oregon legislature passed, and the governor signed into law House Bill 2267, known by the Oregon Travel and Tourism Industry as the Oregon Tourism Investment Proposal. This initiated the statewide lodging tax, and it put definitions in place on the use of local lodging taxes. It's important to note that this was a bill that was brought forward by Oregon's travel and tourism industry and then made part of Governor Kulongoski's budget and program of work. The Oregon travel and tourism industry believed, and the legislature concurred in 2003, that there would be a synergistic effect of establishing a dedicated stable funding source for state tourism marketing while ensuring a more stable portion of local lodging tax dollars were being dedicated into the industry that was being taxed for local tourism promotional efforts. As a result, Oregon has been able to compete more effectively for visitor dollars, resulting in very positive impacts for the state of Oregon. Since 2003, visitor spending is up 66%, from $6.5 billion to $10.8 billion. Direct employment in Oregon's travel and tourism industry is up 23%, from 84,500 jobs in 2003 to over 105,000 jobs today. Employee earnings are up 65%, from $1.7 billion in 2003 to $2.8 billion today. State and local taxes that are generated by visitors are up 89%, from $246 million in 2003 to over $450 million today. In fact, in the 10 years following the passage of HB 2267, local tax revenues grew 84%. And prior to the passage of House Bill 2267, total local taxes that were resulting from travel across the state of Oregon were growing on average of about $5 million a year statewide. However, after the implementation of House Bill 2267, local taxes grew on average statewide by $8 million annually, an increased growth rate of 62%. Collectively, as the statewide tourism industry, we've successfully gained market share of an expanding global tourism industry. When the Oregon Tourism Investment Proposal went into full effect in 2005, Oregon's share of visitor spending was 0.97%. By 2014, which are the most recent numbers that we have available, our share had grown to 1.12%. Now, lest you wonder if 0.15% is a meaningful number, what I can tell you today is that 0.1% is the equivalent of shifting over $900 million from other destinations to Oregon's market share. So that 0.15% shift is equal to a $1.4 billion shift in growth in Oregon's share of visitor spending. Throughout the 13 years since the passage of the tourism investment proposal, the potential to strategically focus dedicated state and local resources at driving demand for travel to and within Oregon has been realized. When transient lodging taxes were first implemented in the United States, there was a defined nexus between the industry-specific sales tax and the investment of all of the resulting revenue derived from the tax back into the industry. When HB 2267 was enacted, it was estimated that a statewide average of about 45% of local lodging taxes were directed towards local tourism efforts, although that percentage varied through each of those various jurisdictions that I mentioned earlier. A later study that was carried out in 2008 by Eco Northwest identified an average of about 48% going to tourism from local communities across the state. Now, cities and counties are permitted by the state of Oregon to charge a local transient lodging tax for temporary lodging at hotels, motels, campgrounds, and other temporary lodgings. As was noted earlier, the 2003 legislature passed HB 2267, which was then codified in ORS 320.300, and it resulted in the following changes. It established the 1% statewide lodging tax. It required that pre-existing local levels of support for tourism continue. And it put in place requirements about how new or increased local lodging taxes can be spent. The legislative direction on spending existing or new transient lodging tax revenues was designed in part to maintain or to increase the spending of transient lodging tax revenues on tourism as a reinvestment in the tourism industry. ORS 320.300 provides the following definitions of tourism and related activities. A tourist is someone who has traveled over 50 miles or stayed overnight for a purpose that's not related to, for example, a regular commute for work or for education. Tourism is all economic activity that then results from tourists. Tourism promotion can mean a variety of different activities as codified in ORS 320. For example, advertising, publishing and distributing information, conducting strategic planning and research, operating tourism promotion agencies, and marketing special events and festivals. A tourism-related facility was also defined in ORS 320, and a tourism-related facility means a conference center, convention center, or visitor information center, and it also means other real property that has a 10-year useful lifespan and has a substantial purpose of supporting tourism or accommodating tourism activities. The legislation also made the following changes. Jurisdictions with a local lodging tax as of July 2, 2003 are required to maintain, but also permitted to increase, the amount spent on tourism as a percent of their net local transient lodging tax revenues. From July 2, 2003 forward, local governments must direct at least 70% of the new or expanded tax revenue to support tourism. So if a local jurisdiction increases an existing or begins a new transient lodging tax, then 70% must be used for tourism promotion or tourism-related facilities, and 30% is unrestricted in use. One of the more recent examples I could provide you this morning would be Tillamook County, who a couple of years ago implemented a new 10% countywide lodging tax with 10% of that money, or excuse me, 70% of that money directed to the tourism industry and 30% being dedicated to improving county roads. The statutes guiding the spending of transient lodging tax revenue restrict spending of TLT revenues from lodging taxes in effect prior to July 2, 2003 in the following ways. It maintains the share of transient lodging tax spent on tourism. Local jurisdictions are required to at least maintain the share of local transient lodging tax used for tourism promotion or tourism-related facilities based on their spending on or after July 2, 2003. For example, any community that was spending 50% of their local transient lodging tax revenue to fund tourism on July 1, 2003 may not spend less than that 50% of local transient lodging tax revenue to fund tourism in the future. The recipients of the tax may change, but the percentage used for tourism purposes cannot be reduced. It also requires that agreements on increasing the spending of tourism must be honored. Local jurisdictions that agreed before July 2, 2003 to increase spending on tourism funding by local lodging taxes must raise the tax as they agreed to. And finally, they are encouraged, required rather, to continue financing debt with transient lodging tax revenue. A local jurisdiction that is financing debt with local transient lodging tax must continue to finance that debt until the retirement of that debt, including any refinancing of that debt. At the time of the debt retirement, then, the tax either must be eliminated or would comply with regulations for new or increased local lodging taxes. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and to provide you with this context, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Representative Gumberg, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I may, and thank you for that overview, Todd. First question is this. Vacation lodging is undergoing some changes. And you mentioned the Tillamook County example, and I, of course, represent the southern half of Tillamook County. In Tillamook County, we now have 1,100 vacation rentals and an untold number of other informal rentals like Airbnbs. So my first question is, are we collecting all the money that's due to us? How good a job are our local jurisdictions doing at collecting transient room taxes from these new enterprises? Or alternatively, how much money are we leaving on the table?
Chair Leininger, Representative Gumberg, I believe that your question kind of gets to the heart of one of the reasons that there's another piece of legislation before this this body, and that's the one that would allow the sharing of information regarding tax collections between local government and state government. For example, the State Department of Revenue is responsible for collecting the state lodging tax, whereas city financial offices and others are the ones responsible for collecting local lodging taxes. The synergy, the efficiencies that could be garnered if there could be a sharing of data to make sure that there is full compliance at the local, the county, and the state level, has been identified as something, I believe, by the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and others, the Department of Revenue, that would help them in that efficiency. I believe the Department of Revenue is on record as stating that their confidentiality requirements bind them from being able to share the state data. So your question is a fair one, of which I couldn't sit here before you today and tell you with assurance that there is 100% compliance in collections at the state and local level. I believe we've got folks that are doing tremendous work, and we have folks that are well intentioned that are running vacation rentals and the like. But whether or not there's 100% compliance, whether by accident or design, I'm unable to provide you an answer with any certainty this morning.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. My second question is, again, Todd, you're in the tourism business. Tillamook County, again, with the new transient room tax, is generating close to $2 million a year in new revenues. Under current law, we're required to spend 70% of that on tourism promotion. And the question before us today is whether we commit that to advertising or can use it for other purposes. Now, I'll tell you, in my district, that's a divided question, and there are strong feelings. Some in the business community saying, bring it on, let's use that advertising to strengthen our shoulder months. Other people are saying that those many tourists that come to us generate trash, they generate calls for police and fire support, they help our roads deteriorate more quickly, and tourism promotion should include more than just advertising, but also taking care to make sure those tourists have a positive experience and a safe experience here and cleaning up after they've left. As a tourism professional, talk to us for just a moment about the tourism experience and whether spending dollars to address the impact of tripling the size of a small coastal community on any given summer weekend, whether that's going to bring us more visitors in the future or whether it's going to deteriorate our advertising impact.
Chair Leininger, Representative Gumberg, first, as a point of clarification, you mentioned that Tillamook County spending 70% of the approximately $2 million on tourism promotion. And, of course, by statute, it could be tourism promotion. It could also be tourism-related facilities. They could look at visitor information centers. I've heard talk of interest in conference centers in Tillamook County, so they could really work on the shoulder season and bring some larger meetings to that portion of the Oregon coast as well. Those are all permissible expenditures as well. So it could be promotion, but it could also be an investment in tourism-related facilities also. So that would be the one key clarification that I would certainly make. I would also acknowledge that there are local lodging taxes that are going back in to mitigate some of those impacts. As I mentioned in my comments earlier, the the share of lodging tax that was going in, back into the tourism industry, be it tourism facilities or tourism promotion, prior to 2003 was approximately 45%. That meant 55% was available to local governments to use in a variety of ways, including mitigating those impacts. One of the reasons that the statutes in 2267 said that any tax increase after July 2nd, 2003 was shared at a 70-30 ratio was because there was compromise between the industry and the local governments about, you know, I'm sure one side would have liked zero and one side would have liked 100%. And what was determined by the legislature is that the balance felt right at 70-30, where 70% would go back into tourism, tourism promotion, and tourism-related facilities. 30% was available to local governments to use then to mitigate impacts if they needed to expand water treatment facilities and those kinds of services. So it is an important component. You know, as you said, the overarching experience that folks have when they come to Oregon is unprecedented. We're very blessed in that way to be able to call Oregon home, and certainly me, I feel that way in my role as the director of your state tourism office. That experience is that's the story we tell when folks come to Oregon. So, but I believe that there have been steps made to make sure that there are opportunities for local governments to be able to address those impacts through the legislation that's been put in place since 2003.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for this witness? We do have a number of people who've traveled to be here. We want to make sure we give them a chance to share their views as well. All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my pleasure. And, you know, I'm here in town, so if you need me to come back to answer any further questions, I'm only too happy to do so.
And, you know, it may be that if this committee carries forward as a freestanding economic development committee, as you know, it was originally in previous years, it's been linked to transportation, then we will certainly want to strengthen our knowledge base of tourism-related issues and how all of that range of economic development works going forward. So this is a great foundational opportunity to meet with you and hear about two important bills. All right, so we are going to be moving into House Bill 2768 and calling Wendy Johnson first because she has a PowerPoint on both of the bills. But I want to note that a number of the opponents of these bills signed up for the other hearing because it was numerically first, and I want to make sure that they don't get boxed out of an opportunity to share their perspective fairly early on. So I'm going to make sure that we have somewhat of a balance of opponents and proponents on this first bill, and many people may choose to testify only once if they feel like their comments span the two bills, but we will have separate public hearings. So we're opening a public hearing on House Bill 2768. Ms. Johnson, please go ahead. If you could keep your remarks under 5 minutes, that would be good, because we have quite a number of people. And then on deck we have Lance Colley from the city of Roseburg, and also I'm gonna call Mayor John Stromberg from the city of Ashland. Thank you.
Chair Leininger and members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League supports both bills, and so I'll just testify on one, or just this one time, but we do support both. We think that they work well together, or we could make amendments to put them together or such. Many of you know that I mostly focus on finance issues for the League and tax issues. So this is one of those that straddles both tax and economic development. We support tourism in our cities. It's one of the lifeblood engines of the economies in our cities. And so this is one of those issues where we have to work together, and we want to partner with tourism promotion. And these bills, we believe, will help continue to promote tourism, but address a preemption issue that we have. Mr. Davidson has explained some of the issues, so I'm hoping I can skip some of the slides. Some of the basic facts here we've already discussed. Over 91 of our cities have a lodging tax. That's the important takeaway. And the tax rates themselves vary. For cities, it's $87 million a year is what we're bringing in local lodging taxes. The total is 136 for the counties and cities together. So you see the pie chart there. The light blue is the state lodging tax revenues. The dark blue is what the locals are bringing in. It's these are the numbers are great. They're continuing to go up and up, and you know, starting at they've like almost tripled since 2000. So here's the heart of it: what we're regulated on. It's complicated because there's two different dates here. There are two different formulas to keep in mind. What happened in 2003 was the state passed a state tax, the 1%, and then in this last short session, it went from 1% to 1.8%. But to get that vote, frankly, through, it required a 3/5 vote. It was a state tax. It was a revenue-raising issue. So to get that vote for the 3/5 vote, there was also a preemption on locals saying, okay, you've been doing your local tax for years, actually since the 1930s, but we're now going to start preempting you on how you use your money and also some other details. And it was a hard-fought debate that lasted the entire session. Lane Shetterly was chair of the Revenue Committee then and later became one of my bosses, and he explained the battle. At cross-partisan divides, it was a messy fight. But nobody, the governor didn't want this preemption and went on record to say that as well, but he needed it to get the vote through because our state did not have a state tourism commission, did not have a state tourism promotion entity, and now we do because of that 1% being dedicated to have that state entity. Frankly, Todd Davidson and his shop at Travel Oregon have done a bang-up job because we now have tourists coming to the state in droves that we did not have before. We were one of the lowest ranked states for how much we put towards tourism. But let me remind you, what he also said was before the bill, 45% of tourism dollars, the local tax dollars, were going towards tourism promotion. They did that on their own. The state didn't tell them how much to spend or when to spend. Instead, what happened with this bill is we froze. Where everybody was, you're froze. And so think about your local towns, how much they have changed, what the budget needs have changed each year. You may need water this year, you may need transportation the next year. We're all froze. So if you were putting a lot towards tourism, well, you're going to have to continue to put a lot towards tourism. If you weren't doing any, you don't have to do any because we just arbitrarily picked this in statute. And so we're asking you to take a look at that. Was that really the right balance? The League recently did a survey. The Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association actually asked us to look into this. So where were people? We had 80% of the cities respond, and that's just been in the last couple of weeks, so we're still compiling all the data. 27 cities are in this situation where they have not raised the tax since 2003, but they're frozen at a rate. And they range, two of those cities of the 27 are at zero to give back towards tourism. Three are at 100% have to go back towards tourism. And then the rest are in the middle, and the average is 40% are in this frozen group. And then if you do an increase on taxes, or you didn't have a lodging tax in 2003, but now you do, as you just heard, like for Clackamas example, Tillamook, it has to be 70% go towards tourism. So we have 32 cities in this category that didn't have a tax in 2003, and so they imposed one now. So they're at 70% has to go towards tourism. And then I have 13 that are in this middle group that had a tax in 2003, then did an increase, and so we have to do this complex formula, and I haven't been able to figure out all that math because it's complex. So this is the patchwork we have, and it's inequitable. It's from 0 to 100 and everything in between, and it does not allow local choice. The key definitions here are, so tourism, using it towards tourism, there's those two definitions. There's tourism promotion and there's tourism related facility. So that's the two, if you're dedicating it towards tourism, it has to fit in one of those two boxes. And they're interesting boxes. This tourism promotion, if you look at the underlying words, that's the key parts of it. These are all very marketing. So to fall into the promotion bucket, it's advertising, publicizing, strategic planning, promotion agencies, and marketing. So there's nothing in here that is really outside of the marketing area. The second choice is the facility. You can use your money for facilities. Many of our cities do not have a facility that fits this list of a conference center, a convention center, or a visitor information center. Their tourist place is to recreate. It's the mountain. It's the ocean. It's whatever the surroundings are. So they don't have this building. So the other option is this letter B here, other improved real property that has a useful life of 10 years and has a substantial purpose of supporting tourism. or accommodating tourists. Each one of those words has great meaning, and I've given you in OLIS the Attorney General opinion on what that means. And it goes through, it's a 16-page opinion that goes through each one of those words, and you can see the legislative history and what the legislators were thinking back then and talking about sewer and talking about transportation and all these things. There was intent to provide flexibility, and if I had more time, I'd actually read that into the record of what the legislators were talking about. But both sides of the aisle wanted flexibility. This is the deal they came up with. But after the dust all settled and everyone left, and we got the AG opinion, they're like, well, this doesn't really provide the flexibility you thought it did. These words all have great meaning that you really can't use it for transportation, even if it's tourist related. You can't use it for public safety, even if it's tourist related, because it doesn't fit these words. So that's what we're about today. The one bill would change the promotion definition, brought to make it more flexible, and the tourist-related facility is in the other bill. There are pros and cons with both of them, I suppose. But the point is that each city has a different need, and each county has a different need. But we would like to be working together. We don't see this as just marketing or facilities, meaning that's the only way to provide tourism promotion. If the experience isn't a good experience, folks are not going to come back. And we think that's what needs to be addressed. Every community has their own financial issues, and each one is different. So this is the choices I could have brought to you today. We could have asked to eliminate the 70-30 number, or asked you to change that to make it 60-40 or 50-50 or something like that. We could ask you to lift the weird preemption that froze us in time, but we chose not to do that, instead to change the definitions to focus on, okay, we're still going to use the money for tourism. It's just not going to be for these two odd ways of only facilities or only marketing. So that's what we did. Our goal, we hope that you see, is that we want to continue tourism.
Great. I'm going to ask you to wrap up because we have a number of people, but you know, if you want to take a minute to close out your talk.
Okay. This slide is just to remind you what you passed in the 16th session. The state did the same thing. This is just an excerpt from House Bill 4146, the state increase. You'll see the bracketed there, marketing, both times, both in sub A and sub B. The state deleted that as well, and now the state can use its money for a tourism program. And so that's what we're looking for, is the same kind of flexibility, just the same thing. Again, this is the difference between the two bills. 2744 is tourism facility, and 2768 is tourism promotion. These were our top needs. We, as I said, we did the survey. A large chunk of our cities simply want to use some of their money for beautification, making their city look good, making it welcoming to tourists. The second top thing was public safety, but it's for the event. So the big festival that you need the extra security for, the marathon, whatever it is. And then lastly, transportation was the third request. This is for those revenue folks, just to show that we are getting revenues from the people who live in the town to pay for the services as well. But the numbers are so large on the lodging tax that we want to be good stewards of our funds and use some of it in a different way than just the marketing or facilities. And on OLIS, you have these items, and you can take a look at them.
Excellent.
And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. All right. And I'm going to thank you for coming up and invite you to sit down, take your regular seat again. And now I'm actually going to do something a little bit unusual. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2768 and open a joint public hearing on House Bill 2768 and 2744. And in the interest of efficiency for people's testimony, we're going to invite people to testify on either or both bills for the remainder of the time. And I'm going to alternate sort of between proponents and opponents. I'm going to first invite Mr. Crawford to very succinctly summarize the differences, and that was actually a helpful introduction that you gave as well on the differences. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2768 expands the definition of tourism promotion for purposes of transient lodging tax revenue expenditures to include providing for tourism programs, beautification projects, benches, parking facilities, restrooms, and the construction or improvement of sidewalks. It takes effect on the 91st day after sine die. House Bill 2744 adds improvements to to real property that have the substantial purpose of supporting, promoting, or accommodating tourism or tourism activities to the definition of tourism-related facilities. Makes a series of changes both to the frozen and unfrozen sections regarding tax expenditures, and takes effect on the 91st day after sine die.
Excellent. All right. And so now let's have come forward Lance Colley, Gil Riddle, and John Stromberg, a panel of proponents. And then since there's some overlap, I'm going to call forward next Richard Boyles, Bill Perry, and John Erickson to speak to both bills as you wish, and then we'll have an additional panel of proponents after that. Thanks, gentlemen, and if you could each keep your comments to, you know, probably about 2 or 3 minutes, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. I'm Lance Colley. I'm the city manager at the City of Roseburg. I'm here representing our city council, who has not formally taken a position on this, but has talked about the needs in our community and the impacts of tourism and transient lodging in our community for many years. I'd like to thank Representative Gomberg for talking about the issues in Tillamook County. We face similar issues in Douglas County and the City of Roseburg, where when we have a specific event, we may have 5,000 to 15,000 people coming in our community, and our general fund resources are taxed by that. I want to first say we are very supportive of tourism in our community. It's a huge impact on our economic situation, and we're not opposed to spending resources on tourism. What we would like you to consider is expanding the definition a little bit to provide us with some flexibility to meet the impacts of tourism as well as the marketing component of the tourism industry. We have had our tax since 1982. It was voted on by the local electorate, and at the initial period of time, only 35% of the money was allocated to tourism. Since 1982, but prior to 2003, when the original legislation went into impact, we raised our tax from 5% to 6% to 7% to 8%. All of that money went to tourism. So we were making choices pre-legislation to impact the tourism industry, and we utilize it for marketing. There does come a point where you get diminishing returns, and the impact on the community switches from a positive impact to, in some cases, a potential negative impact because we can't deal with the impact of tourism. So we're here to support tourism, to support marketing of tourism, but also to support flexibility in rural Oregon, where we really don't have mechanisms to deal with the impact of tourism. And so we respectfully request that you consider providing a little bit of flexibility both of these bills do. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Mr. Riddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Gil Riddle, Policy Director, Association of Oregon Counties. I would like, with your permission, to add a little bit of color, the background, which has been lacking to this point. But first of all, notice the letter submitted electronically to your committee from Hood River County Sheriff Matt English on behalf of the Oregon State's Sheriff's Association. 15 counties have local transit lodging taxes. Until 2003, the TLT had always been local, managed by locally elected officials, local communities working with local businesses and stakeholders have been perfectly able to shape and approve the TLT that best fit local circumstances. All counties used at least a share of their proceeds for economic development and tourism. In 2003, a group representing tourism, the tourism industry, successfully imposed new restrictions and limits on local TLTs, directed specific purposes of the local tax to benefit a particular industry. Notwithstanding the new 1% statewide transit lodging tax, they tried to take all 100% of the local transit lodging taxes as well. Fortunately, the 2003 legislature instead imposed limitations, overly rigid, and that we object to, but did that, and you've heard about the limitations and the limitations in the definition. Well, one point I want to leave you is that local jurisdictions were left with not more than 30% of the original intention of the transit lodging tax program. In 2008, there was alarm about the impending expiration of the Secure Rural Schools Act, a nationwide safety net for counties that are dominated by federal forest in their counties. It was about to expire. Governor Kuligowski called together a task force, Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services. It involved included legislators from both chambers, both sides of the aisle, state agency directors, and county and city representatives. Of the 53 recommendations was recommendation number 3. And this was published in January 2008. Amend state law to give counties the authority to use existing revenues more flexibly. Allow all transit lodging tax receipts to be used by counties and cities for tourism-related services, including emergency services, law enforcement, and roads. The annual revenue potential for hard-hit counties, those counties that were particularly dependent on federal forest revenues, would be $11.2 million to $37.4 million a year.
Thank you so much for your testimony. If you can wrap up in the next minute, we would appreciate that.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. The expiration of Secure Rural Schools did not happen. However, it since has happened. It is now a reality. This is directly relevant today as it was in 2009. We strongly support both bills. They loosen overly rigid statutory restrictions. They make modest real-world improvements on needlessly restrictive definitions that were imposed upon perfectly functioning local transit lodging tax. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much, Representative Brock-Smith, and then we're going to try to move forward through the remaining speakers. Thanks.
Just two questions. Okay. One, City Administrator, what does your Roseburg Chamber think of these bills? Have you reached out? Have they reached out?
Our contract for tourism promotion is through the local Chamber of Commerce, and they get 90% of the tourism dollars. So I can tell you that I would imagine that they don't support more flexibility. That's why we're here talking from a local elected official perspective and a local government perspective.
Sure.
And Mr. Riddell, I appreciate your historic perspective on this. It's important, especially from the counties and local governments. So
thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, gentlemen. And
thank
now
you, Chair.
We'll
thank
call
you,
forward,
committee.
Please, Richard Boyle, Bill Perry, and John Erickson. I'm going to actually ask everyone to keep your testimony to no more than 3 minutes, and we're going to use a stopwatch to help ensure that as many people as possible have a chance to testify going forward. He is going to go, since we have someone who'd like to testify by phone from a remote location, and we're going to have that person go last. And we have a number of additional people who've also traveled who are in the room, and we'll try to get to everyone before we make that final call. All right, welcome.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I'll try to go speedy so you can ask questions if I go too fast for you. But we keep talking about preemption. It's not a preemption. Local governments can still raise the tax. Now, this is a statewide funding mechanism. It's not unusual for the state to protect its funding mechanism, much like gas taxes. Gas taxes are protected at the local level to go into infrastructure, so your state and your locals work together. That's the intent here. I also want to say 20% of your gas taxes are paid by tourists. And so in a high tourist area, those people buying gas in there, they're paying for the roads in the area. The other thing that I want to talk about is the Runyon study that that Mr. Davidson talked about where local governments spend their money. A majority of the money is still spent and goes to general fund. In that study, it basically said only 48% goes to tourism programs. Now, that was an entertaining presentation, but when they talked about tourism facilities, of that 48%, over two-thirds of it goes to tourism facilities, not tourism promotion. Less than a third goes to tourism promotion. So if you start eroding the tourism promotion and changing the definitions, you're taking the smallest portion of it. Most of it is still spent in facilities. Also, I want to touch on Representative Gomberg's question in Tillamook County, because I think all of this is relevant to how complicated this is. Tillamook County raised the tax to 10%, but they did it so it would be uniform. And so you look at Manzanita. Manzanita has a 9% local tax. 100% of it goes to general fund, and 100% went before 2003, even though they said some of these guys were spending it on promotion before 2003. That's not correct. So the county only added 1% to Manzanita. So as that goes up, Manzanita is benefiting their general fund from the increased tourism promotion, because that 9% is growing with the tourists. And so I know City of Bend put this bill, the next bill forward. They still get 65% or just 64% of all the tourist dollars go to general fund, and only 35% goes to tourism promotion. And so their estimate went up, was missed. So there's another $3 million going to Bend this year, $2.9 million. So $1.8 million of that is going to general fund, and only $1 million of it is going to tourism promotion. So the local governments and the general funds are still benefiting more than tourism promotion, and facilities is benefiting more than tourism promotion. So we need to put this in perspective, and any change you make is going to erode those dollars in most of the jurisdictions, because if you allowed somebody to build benches, you're going to have probably 30% of those jurisdictions build benches because they want to spend that money elsewhere. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. We'll go through the remaining people on the panel and then and see if there are questions. Welcome. Please begin by stating your name for the record.
My name is Richard Boyles. Chair Lininger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. So as I said, my name is Richard Boyles. I'm here to provide a perspective about the importance of the tourism promotion portion of the tax. I'm president of Insight Hotel Management Group. We currently operate 12 hotels in Oregon and two in Washington. Also president of Psyche and Development Corporation. We have four hotels under development in Oregon. And with my wife, we own and operate Iris Vineyards in the South Willamette Valley since 1996. So I'm a developer and operator of tourism-dependent businesses for over 20 years. My industry service includes long service on Travel Lane County's board. I recently joined the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association board, and last year was appointed as a commissioner on the Oregon Tourism Commission. This industry engagement has given me a further perspective on the importance of tourism promotion to our state and locales. So I'm testifying today as a multi-business creator and operator in the hospitality sector. As such, my businesses are dependent on a stable funding mechanism for tourism promotion at the state and local level, and the effective expenditure of those funds. And I request that my testimony be considered in terms of both bills and entered into the record for both bills, if possible. So I am offering my testimony in opposition to bills that would change the funding mechanism or divert allocation of funds from tourism promotion. Funds invested in tourism promotion enjoy a tremendous multiplier effect in Oregon's economy. These funds create and sustain jobs and businesses provide a lot of income tax revenue to the state as a result. TRT invested in tourism promotion generates more TRT, a significant portion of which goes to city and county general funds available for a variety of non-tourism-related purposes. Diversion of TRT from tourism promotion will diminish those benefits. As a business owner dependent on effective tourism promotion, and as a developer making decisions about where to invest in new tourism facilities, I value certainty in the funding model. I would also say that during my time as chair of Travel Lane County, I was involved in several attempts of the county to reallocate funds, and saw the turmoil that that created in the organization and the distraction from the mission, and ultimately those were not the best of times for tourism promotion in Lane County. So I respectfully request that you take no action with respect to the bills or any bills that would change the funding model and diminish the benefits of tourism promotion dollars. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Welcome, Mr. Erickson.
Thank you for inviting me, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. I've been in the hospitality industry. My name is John Erickson. I'm chairman for Tourism Development Council for Clackamas County. Been in the industry for 51 years. The one thing that I don't think a lot of people have spoken to is what money is generated truly by the tourists coming to the area. $4 is generated for every dollar spent on promotion and marketing for tourism. It is one of the largest generators of additional revenue for this state since the original tax was imposed. I started out 50 years ago at the Benson Hotel. At that time, there was very little tourism to this state. It has generated probably some of the most growth in jobs and revenue generation that we've seen ever in the history of this state. The one thing about the 70-30 split right now that was developed, 30% was planned in the tax to go to the local counties, cities, municipalities to offset any additional cost for supporting tourism coming into the area. Oregon has grown tremendously in awareness across the world for tourist destination marketing. And at this time, if you take a look at what is generated on an annual basis, the jobs produced within Oregon for tourism has grown tremendously just since that time that the tax was implemented. So I speak against these two bills, because we don't want to see a drop of $4 for every dollar taken away from transit, lodging tax, promotion, and marketing. It's very important to make sure that we stay consistent, keep the awareness going across the nation and across the world that Oregon is a great destination to go to. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. All right. So we don't have these bills scheduled for a work session today. This is a public hearing day, so I'm going to ask us to hold our questions unless you feel like you have something that's really burning so we can get all the way through our witnesses. The next panel, thank you, gentlemen. The next panel is the last panel of people in the room, and then we are going to place a call to the mayor of City of Ashland, John Stromberg. Let's have Carolyn Egan of the City of Bend, Thomas Mosier of the Sun River Owners Association, and Bill Cross with the Oregon Destination Marketing Organization come forward, and we'll ask you each to keep your comments to 3 minutes so that we have time for everyone, and then we will make a call to the mayor of Ashland. Thank you so much. Ms. Egan, would you like to begin?
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Carolyn Egan. I serve as the Economic Development Director for the City of Bend. So as a person who cares about tourism and economic development, I'm here today to support House Bill 2744. I think we talk a lot about percentages when we talk about transient lodging tax, but we don't talk a whole lot about whole numbers. And what's really important for me right now is that when this tax or this law was adopted in 2003, the total transient lodging tax collection in the City of Bend was $2.5 million. We were allocating $640,000 to tourism promotion. In the next 5 years, we will probably be at $13 million in transient lodging tax collection, which puts us, based on the existing law, at over $4 million in tourism promotion. So right around 2015, 2014, we were putting more dollars into promotion than we were even collecting in 2003 when this law was passed. So in 2003, you'd not yet logged on to your first Facebook status update. You may have just registered for the Do Not Call list. So things have changed. This was a visionary bill in 2003, and the changes that are requested in our bill really are asking us to be visionary for the next 17 years. We hadn't thought about tourist facilities being anything but conference centers, performing arts centers back then. We didn't even know that that would happen. But now in Bend, when we talk about group sales, we're not necessarily thinking about overnight and about events at our convention center. We're talking about cross-country nationals that brought over 500 competitors to Bend in February during the worst winter on record in Bend, which made our overnight stays, our ADR, and our higher than any other February on record. So we really need to think about tourist facilities differently going forward. We would really like the next visionary bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Great job keeping your comments really concise. I apologize that we're having to make people limit their time. Thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Mosier. I'm here for the Sun River Owners Association. I represent 4,200 member owners who live all across the state. We're here to register our support for House Bill 2768. Sun River Second Homes alone represent an estimated $3.9 million of transient room tax to Deschutes County, estimated $6 million total countywide for the fiscal year, which in turn supports Deschutes County's tourism industry, a significant economic driver in the region. We recognize that attracting tourists is not merely limited to specific installations, but a welcoming atmosphere that includes events and promotion, as well as a local infrastructure that comfortably supports tourism. For that reason, we feel that it's very important for the region that the tourism and hospitality industry is supported, and this bill gives us the flexibility to do that right. We really appreciate the idea of expanding the ways that we can actually promote and grow what brings people to these areas. It's not just the promotion; it's actually the areas themselves, the amenities, and the beautification projects that we can do that bring people to these communities to stay. So I support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Cross.
Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations, which are throughout the state from coast to eastern Oregon, from Portland to Ashland. They're oftentimes connected to the Chamber of Commerce or a local DMO, Destination Marketing Organization, that may have a contract to help promote their local communities. And over the years, they've done a pretty good job, and we've seen some of the returns, some of the numbers, and that success doesn't come overnight. It takes years to build a good marketing promotional effort campaign. You're competing with not only other communities in the state of Oregon, but obviously out-of-state areas, and it literally takes a long-term investment, both for the state of Oregon and local communities. And so our past legislation has offered that. We've had the sustainability and the certainty to make those kind of investments in our communities, which is why ODMO asks that you not move 2744 or 2768 forward. This would represent an erosion of the commitment we've made to our communities, to tourism, and it's played such an important part of the economic development in urban and rural areas across the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. We are going to now place a call to the mayor of the city of Ashland, who is speaking in favor of one or both bills, and then we may have a minute or two at the end if folks want to make comments about this again. We would be returning to these bills at a subsequent meeting if we were moving them forward, so we'll have some additional opportunity to talk about it.
Hello.
Hi, Mayor Stromberg. This is Ann Leininger from the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade.
Hi, Chair Leininger. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hey, thank you so much for your willingness to provide your comments on these bills. We're asking people to keep their comments to within 3 minutes, so we would love to hear what you have to say.
Okay, I have to say I'm speaking in my capacity as mayor because the council didn't have enough time to have a meeting with public input on this, but that isn't to be interpreted that they don't agree completely with me, because I'm sure that they do.
Okay, great. Hey, please be sure to introduce your name for the record, and thank you.
Hans Stromberg, mayor of the city of Ashland.
Great.
So it boils down to this. We were working on the budget Monday, scrambling on the budget for every penny we can find, and we're anticipating $5.8 million in TOT receipts in the coming biennium. $1.5 million of those are restricted, $877,000 will go to the Visitor and Convention Bureau, $220,000 to the Shakespeare Festival, and that is a wonderful engine of promotion and things that attract people to come to Ashland, and it works really well, and the revenues are steadily climbing. The problem is the PERS increase over that same period of time is $4 million, and we are looking for every single penny. You couldn't believe how much work is going into trying to pull this budget together under that stress. What happens in Ashland is we have 20,000 people, 300,000 visitors a year, and they come for the Shakespeare Festival, but they come back because of the quality of life, and that has to do with issues of how our downtown looks and functions directly. So all we're asking for is flexibility, not more money. Here's what we would do with that flexibility. Beautification and wayfinding projects in our downtown area, which would include such things as hanging flower baskets, building facade improvements, improvements in street lighting, planter boxes, and landscaping. Then also capital projects like repairing our sidewalks, making improvements to benches, making sure our restrooms are up to snuff. And the third thing would be master planning for these downtown improvements and capital projects. And so this whole equation, it works beautifully in Ashland. I assume most of you have been there. I hope you will come if you haven't. And at the same time, in this stress of dealing with the PERS hit, flexibility would be tremendously valuable to us and entirely consistent with the purpose of this tax. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We sure appreciate your comments. Does anybody have any questions for the mayor? And if not, we will thank you for your call and offer committee members an opportunity to just voice comments in general.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
See you.
Committee members, any reflections, comments on this this important issue of tourism growth and economic development? Yes, Representative Brocksmith.
So, as an 8-year chamber president and director, and also having that hat on, small business owner, and then 8-year city councilor and 4-year county commissioner, I understand the complexities of both sides of this discussion. I was actually leaning more one way before the mayor's comments with regards to bringing up the PERS hit, because that's not what this is about. And that reference is concerning, because these dollars need to be moved to other areas. I think local government, in some of the opposition testimony we talked about, were these dollars need to go and the tourism promotion activities that bring in more dollars. But we need to remember that as I was the chamber president, but I was also the city councilor. And so that happens throughout our local communities, to where you have the benefit of working amongst one another and working with the chambers on a local level and with the county, so that you can script where those dollars should go. It's unfortunate that we have to deal with this type of stuff here rather than working at the local level to benefit each other, but we must.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Representative Gomberg and then Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I've got constituents who feel very strongly both ways on these issues, and I always vote to support my constituents. That being said, we've got two bills in front of us, one dealing with promotion, one dealing with facilities. It would be helpful, as I struggle with this, to have a better sense of really how much money is being spent on facilities versus promotion. I know that's going to be difficult to dredge out, but I do think that it would be important to understand how this money, this 70% or whatever percent is being applied, is actually being spent on facilities versus promotion.
Thank you. We'll have Mr. Crawford do some research for us and get back to us on that. Unless there is someone in the room right now who definitively knows the answer to that. No, we'll get back to the committee with some information. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was for 4 years a city councilor alongside Mayor Stromberg. So let me just elaborate a little bit on his comments. I believe that his reference to PERS was simply to note that the pressures on the general funds are tremendous right now. So to the extent that those funds have to be tapped for things like beautification, landscaping, restrooms, master planning, those projects are likely to fall by the wayside, unless we can see our way forward to build in some more flexibility into the TOT. So I think that the budget woes on one side just put more of a spotlight on the dollars that are in the TOT to say, yes, we want to support tourism. That is the driver in our town, and certainly that's true in Ashland. And we need to balance the marketing with the ability to actually keep the community's infrastructure that attracts and supports tourism strong as we move forward. So I think that's kind of where he was going with that PERS discussion, not to suggest that you're actually diverting, that you would ever want to divert funding to standard city expenditures, but more that we have to look at really building that infrastructure.
Great point. Thank you so much. All right. I don't see any more comments, but I sure do appreciate the good discussion we had today. The public hearing on these two bills is closed, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Closed, and the